lesson 25, mobilizing resources. Now, in this lesson, and we're starting to get to the end of our road here on this training, and I'm certain that we've ended up going places that you did not anticipate when you first signed up for this advocacy algorithm. But I'm hoping that the journey has nevertheless been edifying, and that you are beginning to see that this kind of information that we've been able to go over in the advocacy algorithm training is useful for more than just your work at the United Nations itself. Today we're going to start by looking at what constitutes mobilizing resources in general, and then we'll move on to the more specific area of looking at mobilizing resources in the context of advocacy. We'll look at why thinking beyond money is important, who should be good at mobilizing resources, what are the steps to mobilizing resources for advocacy in particular, and some actions to include. We'll also look at the two types of power for mobilizing resources in the advocacy context, five steps to mobilizing those resources, and a look at the power grid that can be very useful for getting greater clarity about how to work effectively with stakeholders when we get to that stage. And we'll wrap it up just with a few final thoughts. When an NGO is looking at general resource mobilization, the kinds of questions that they're asking are the following. How can my organization get what is needed, and usually this is put in the context of getting the financial resources needed to sustain our organization and work? Where does an organization get the human resources it needs to carry out its mission? And where are these required resources, and how do we get access to them? First, just a few quick responses to these general questions so we don't blow them off as if they're unimportant, and then we'll get into mobilizing resources for advocacy. First of all, I would encourage you to think beyond money. Money is a good measuring stick for figuring out what it is that we can do, but it's not the only way to mobilize resources. So definitely think beyond. You can even go to including ways of engaging with others, such as bartering. You maybe have resources and strengths that another organization does not. They may have access or strengths or abilities that your organization needs but does not have. And so right there, you can trade. You can barter. You could almost look at barter as a part trading in social currency, that is, in the intangibles such as legitimacy, political support, safety in numbers, whatever it may be that your social capital provides you with. And on the other hand, you've got traditional exchange of currencies such as the US dollar. And barter is sort of halfway in between, where there is an exchange of goods or services rather than just the intangibles and social capital. But nevertheless, it also has economic value. So do think beyond money. It's a very real way. It's not, you cannot do everything that way, but it provides another resource. Next, get people of prime interest to connect with the work being done. Don't just tell them about it or show them pictures. If you have a chance to take them to a facility to meet the people who are benefiting from your organization's work, to have some kind of tangible exchange with those some of your key stakeholders or primary targets that you're interested in connecting with, get them to connect physically with the work that is being done. Naturally, being cost-effective hardly needs to be said, and yet we need to think of it as a dollar that is saved is oftentimes $4 or $5 that don't have to be earned. So remember that every dollar you save in the way you spend the money that you do have access to is that money that doesn't have to be procured some other way. Next, an organic approach to mobilizing resources is through developing the capacity of locals or of the volunteers or of those within the community that is being served through something like cascading training. Now, this is where those perhaps who are volunteers at the local level are trained by the organization. Then those who were trained by the organization, the volunteers themselves, provide the training to those, the next ones coming in. Those volunteers that have been trained can then expand the base of human resources that are available, can reduce the overhead in terms of the costs of training overall, and can still expand the resources that are available to the organization. Some additional key points. Make sure you do keep records. Now, maybe that sounds obvious, but it doesn't always happen. In the day-to-day rush of getting things done, often records are not well kept. Pictures with dates and, you know, whether they be digital pictures or not, keep records. Make sure that you stay in line with your mission and diversify your sources of support. Now, for those of you who were not particularly involved at the institutional level with the mobilization of resources, and you brought in as volunteers or focusing on the United Nations work, it's still good for you to know this as background information. It's good for you to recognize the value of the reports that you were asked to write. They're important for the organization, for the institution as a whole, and for the potential of being able to mobilize other resources in the future. In other words, even your report writing is not just a way of making a contribution. It's still an important part of making a difference. It's important to keep yourself on track, focused on your mission. There are so many things that can be done that need to be done, even to be effective as an individual. Research shows that you are best to focus in on one particular agenda at a time, to do that, get that done, and move on to the next, rather than to spread yourself thin across a number of different missions and a number of different areas of work. And this is absolutely true at the institutional level. Stick with your mission, even if all of the other agenda items that are important to you do need to be done. Overall, you are more effective if you get done what is in front of you and then move on to the next one rather than to spread yourself too thin. Next, always keep an eye on ways that you can diversify your support. And this is a relevant and valid piece of advice, but not always so easy to do, whether you're talking about your individual situation, your NGO, or any kind of enterprise. If the mission that you're pursuing is important enough, then also it's important enough to find ways that you can get multiple donors, multiple forms of support. And this diversity doesn't always just have to be diversity in terms of funding. It can also be in terms of the places from which you get your human resources. In other words, even if your funding, your financial support comes primarily from one large donor, you can diversify and spread your risk, at least by investing very seriously in a volunteer program. So now let's focus on mobilizing the resources for advocacy. And this is where you ask the questions, how can an organization get the leverage it needs to make an impact? Here we're narrowing down and our focus back into the little bit of an intangible realm, those things which will enable us to impact key stakeholders, those things that will enable us to be strengthened in our legitimacy. So, how do you get the leverage? What kind of resources do you need? What will they look like? Where will you find them? How do you go about getting them? So, where are the required resources and how do you benefit from them? How do you use your organization's social capital to make your strategic impact? This is what we're really talking about here. The short answer to these three questions really is what we covered in the last lesson, which was the building of social capital. Social capital is the primary resource that we have to in our advocacy work, But then the question that we're looking at here in this lesson is, how do we mobilize this social capital? How do we cash in on, so to speak, and benefit from the social capital that we've been able to build? Because social capital is one of those fuzzier things, not so easily defined, not everybody agrees on exactly what it is. There are no measurements out there no rules out there by which social capital is measured. Therefore, I want to come back and approach it from yet another perspective so that as we talk about utilizing it, these discussions will in fact help you create a better strategy for your advocacy or in fact for any outreach. Another way to understand it is through this image, static electricity. When the house or the air is very dry and it's the winter time and you move around the house
or your place of work,
just by shuffling your feet around, you're able to build up static electricity. You come to a doorknob, you touch the doorknob, and there's that
potential energy turned into electricity, heat, and sound.
The fact of moving around in a social environment,
when we act responsibly, contribute, support, and more, we naturally build up a reserve of potential energy in the form of social capital. That buildup of potential energy, of course, in the social environment is much more complex than that of static electricity alone. And we've tried to give some kind of an idea of that in this diagram. At least Dr. Gattell and Avis Vidal do so in their book, Community Organizing, Building Social Capital as a Development Strategy.
There are many factors, and I just wanted to list them here. There's confidence, credibility, comfort levels, comprehension, the critiques that go on within either entity or individual, the competence of the parties, the consistency with which actions are taken, the ability to communicate and the types of communications that are engaged in, and the congruence between the actions of what is being said and communicated and the people who are engaged with on a personal level and at the institutional level. All of these things build up the general area, and there are counterbalancing tensions, and there's context which also affect this whole network of
factors. It only really makes sense to map your social capital within a certain context, both in terms of the objectives, the context of the objective, and the context of the community within which your advocacy project is going to take place. So let's go through the five steps of mapping assets with these two main points in mind. Number one, the context within which you're going to be doing this work, and two, which is actually step one in this, as the way this has been laid out, is to have very clear your key outcome. So for example,
we may have many relationships, but when we have an outcome that deals with, for example, poverty, we may have a certain social capital with one organization that is different than we have as social capital on the issue of corruption and good governance
with that same organization.
So to anchor the discussion and the mapping of assets
meaningfully,
it's very important that we first of all define our key outcome that we're addressing in the particular advocacy issue. Advocacy point number two, list the stakeholders. One of your first steps may be to list as many stakeholders as you can, then go back through that list and then try to categorize your stakeholders.
In other words, assess their attitudes to the outcomes. So, for example, you could rank them according to the kind of stakes they have in the outcomes. You could rank them according to how in favor they would be of the outcomes. You may prefer, because of the sensitivity of the issue, rank them in the opposite, according to how against this issue they may be as part of how you're going to begin to figure out your strategy, your alliances, your strategy and your alliances. Then, separately, identify the stakeholder's power relative to the project. In other words, just because a stakeholder has the greatest interest does not necessarily mean that they have the greatest
legitimacy or ability to influence
in the UN environment, for example. So each stakeholder will be perceived differently according to your own organization's interests and agenda, and the context of the work that will be being done. Forms almost a triangulation. You've got the stakeholders, you've got your interests, and you've got the environment or the larger social environment within which the work is being done. Now, in our case here, we're looking at things in the context of the United Nations. So even if a stakeholder is very significant, has huge social capital in relationship to your organization, it may not have enormous social capital in the eyes of the United Nations. That then becomes one of the factors, one of the ways you assess the capacity of that stakeholder to support the outcomes. Understanding that helps you assess how to go about developing your working relationships with and your strategies that you will utilize in your work to achieve the specific outcomes of the agenda that you're working on. And step number 5, determine the various linkages between those stakeholders, the objectives, and all of the elements at play. This here is just to say that these steps get you to think in a systematic way about how you're going to go about fulfilling your agenda and developing a strategy for your particular goal at the United Nations. Now, of course, there are other resources, and we will get onto those shortly. But again, back to these organizations, and I want to distinguish between two types of power to act that is also relevant
to developing your strategic plan. The types of power that we're looking at here are, first,
the type of power that can initiate or enable, can get something going. And sometimes one organization can get something going, another organization can simply enable it to happen without the approval or the blessing, so to speak, of that organization. Getting anything to happen can be very difficult. Others are very good at getting something going, but not necessarily the best in the long term for sustaining the activity.
Hence the second kind of power, maintaining power.
But here I just wanted to introduce the idea also that as you look at your steps for mobilizing your social capital, mobilizing your resources that you do have, another factor that you do need to consider is organizations that are able to initiate, those who enable, and those who are able to sustain
and maintain throughout the process or throughout the duration of the project.
The power to act is also a factor that needs to be considered as you're figuring out your strategy for implementation of your agenda.
This power and attitude grid really just helps you visualize the counterpoint of power and attitude. And so it just lets you think your way through how with your particular agenda, you might assess the various stakeholders as being located somewhere on this grid, and with that location on this grid, you may decide to treat them or deal with them in different ways than if you had not thought about this relationship between power and attitude. You may have decided to do something different. In other words, it's just another tool for you to help you make assessments of your social capital in order to decide how best to utilize that resource as you go forward.
So what we've been going over here have been some of the steps to mobilizing your resources for advocacy, and those actions have included the important aspect of assessment, of considering the types of power that various stakeholders have or some of your associated organizations have. We walked through the five steps of considering what to think about in order to effectively mobilize your resources. We've looked at the power grids and some of the other considerations of what it means to work with stakeholders. And now I want to look at one more very important area, and that is of another resource that is often overlooked and, I would have to say, highly underutilized by many NGOs, in part because it does take an investment. However, the return on investment, the ROI for utilizing and training and working with volunteers
is significant.
So as this last part of mobilizing resources, I just want to spend a little bit more time focusing on some of the benefits of recruiting and sustaining and working with volunteer teams. Now, in fact, we're going to go into the how to do this in Module 6, but right now I just want you to consider a couple of things. If your NGO already has a very comprehensive and integrated volunteer component, then this may just give you some additional perspectives on that. But if not, I would strongly recommend that you answer some of these questions. First of all, I want you to revisit your NGO's agenda at the United Nations or within your community. And from the perspective of human resources, do you currently have the human resources that are needed to accomplish those goals this year? Or perhaps next year. Now, if your objectives at the United Nations include charter change, it may take a few more years, but many other goals do not require that amount of time. And so look more realistically at the time frame that you would require. How long would it take if you had adequate, well-trained staff? In other words, would shifting your view of volunteers to unpaid staff make a difference? Would your NGO be able to achieve its goals quicker, faster, easier if you did rethink your current strategy to either include or significantly upgrade your volunteer program? This is an important question to consider, a very important question to consider. Remember, from a leadership perspective, mobilization is not just about activity. It's about strategic, purposeful activity involving others to achieve clearly defined goals. And if your goals are lofty, then you really need to consider the possibility of increasing, upgrading, expanding the work of your volunteer program. And so we will get to look at that in the coming week. Meanwhile, let's move on to your homework for this lesson. What I want you to do is to think about one of your NGO's objectives at the United Nations. And if you're unaware of what that is, imagine what one might be. And think about the kind of mobilization of resources, of people, of social capital that might be needed to achieve this. Who are the main stakeholders in this objective? While your NGO may be the change agent, who are the other main stakeholders in this objective? And do you need to build a coalition to achieve your goals? Or does your NGO have sufficient social capital or influence to affect the changes alone? Just think about what it will take to achieve your objectives, who you will need to work with you, who you might be influencing, and therefore the kinds of strategies you would need to take up in order to effect that influence. And just map out some of the things that you might need. Go ahead and take 5 minutes. You might be amazed at how clearly you can begin to see what you need to do at the United Nations to reach your goals. Thank you for staying with me today, and I look forward to seeing you in Module 6.